Hello, and thank you for joining this Medcast presentation titled B cells as a treatment target in myasthenia gravis. I am Ali Habib. I'm a board certified neurologist and neuromuscular medicine physician at the University of California, Irvine in Irvine, California. And I am a clinical professor in the Department of Neurology here. I am going to be leading the discussion today. And today our discussion will focus on the evolving treatment landscape of myasthenia gravis, specifically on how novel agents target B cells upstream of the neuromuscular junction. We will also discuss the current standard of care, the unmet needs in managing myasthenia gravis, and how B cell targeted approaches may help close those gaps. Joining us in this conversation is Dr. Arjun Seth, a neurologist, a board-certified neurologist at Northwestern Medicine, assistant professor in the Department of Neurology at the Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. Thank you, Dr. Seth, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Ali, Dr.
All
Habib.
right, let's get into this discussion. So first, Dr. Seth, would you, how do you, when you think about the pathophysiology of myasthenia, what goes through your mind? How do you think about the role of antibody in myasthenia gravis?
Yeah, great question. So, broadly, myasthenia gravis is an autoimmune condition that impacts the neuromuscular junction, so where nerves and muscles are not communicating as well. We think of this as an antibody-mediated process where it's an autoimmune process where antibodies are made typically by B cells with some co-stimulation of T cells that drives then production of those antibodies. And those go impact the neuromuscular junction and prevent that communication between the nerve and the muscle. So that's broad in terms of thinking about different antibodies types. So we have two main. There's several, but there's two main types that we think about. So the one is the acetylcholine receptor binding antibody, and then the muscle-specific tyrosine kinase antibody causing the neuromuscular junction not to communicate as well. And therefore, patients come in and they have eyelid drooping, difficulty swallowing and speaking, chewing, breathing, as well as arm and leg weakness.
And in terms of this being an antibody-mediated disorder, how does this then lead into the further production of the antibody and priming of that antibody production? So what I'm getting at is the role of cells, and which cells do you think are central to the theme of development of myasthenia gravis?
I think we don't specifically know that. So we think a lot of it is B cell mediated, but there is T cells. So two different types of, again, many types of immune cells that exist in the body, but you have T and B cells. And B cells we think of as producing those antibodies, and they largely do produce antibodies and can drive a lot of this in terms of driving myasthenia gravis.
And in terms of you mentioned the different subtypes of myasthenia, and we take the two main subtypes, which is acetylcholine receptor or AChR antibody myasthenia and MuSK myasthenia. Any thoughts on differences in terms of the development of that pathophysiology? And also, what do the differences in these antibodies mean in terms of their disease manifestation and how we approach the treatment in these diseases? Sorry, that's a very long
It's a
question.
long question. Yeah, but it's a good question. So I'll talk about the presentation piece first. So acetylcholine receptor binding antibody or type myasthenia typically presents with eyelid drooping and double vision. So eyes don't move as well as some difficulty swallowing and speaking and can generalize more. So with arm and leg weakness. MuSK myasthenia, so the muscle-specific tyrosine kinase, tends to present with more what we call bulbar dysfunction, so difficulty with swallowing and with the respiratory function first. And they can also manifest with ocular symptoms, but it really is the bulbar piece that drives it. Acetylcholine receptor or AChR myasthenia gravis tends to be driven by these are specific subtypes of IgG. So we think of IgG1 and IgG3 versus MuSK myasthenia is IgG4 mediated disease. And so is more IgG4. And we think of that pathophysiology in terms of how it affects the neuromuscular junction a little bit differently. So IgG1 and IgG3, when they bind, they activate complement and can actually cause degradation of the neuromuscular junction, so worsening of their myasthenia. MuSK does not really target when IgG4 diseases bind, or antibody-mediated diseases bind, they don't really activate complement as much. And so you can tend to think of MuSK as responding a little bit better to B-cell depleting therapies, whereas their data has been somewhat mixed with the acetylcholine receptor, myasthenia gravis, in terms of B-cell depletion with what the CD20 B-cell depletion that has been used so far.
Great, and I will definitely circle back on that point later on in our discussion. And you gave me a nice lead in with the pathophysiology in terms of that complement activation piece, and we'll use that later as well. Before we go on, so we talked about B cells, we talked about antibody production, we talked about downstream mechanisms in terms of complement activation. If you were to draw a line in the sand, there's this whole idea of upstream versus downstream mechanism and mechanistic targets. Where would that line be for you when we're talking about these different areas?
So I think of when we think of any sort of autoimmune disease, we think broadly in terms of like calming down the immune system, and we use a multi-targeted approach on it, truthfully, to actually help people so that they don't have their symptoms related to myasthenia. And so when we think of upstream versus downstream, we think of upstream as where those antibodies are being produced, and then downstream as like where the nerve and the muscle are actually communicating. And where you can target those areas, but they tend to wear off. So they don't last as long. So you need frequent dosing of things. So we tend to use a multi-targeted approach. We use oral medications that can actually help with the neuromuscular junction. So things like pyridostigmine or mestinon, which is really downstream, but it's temporary and wears off. We use other things upstream. So right now, so things like prednisone, mycophenolate, azathioprine. These are medications that we can use upstream that help calm things down. And we have been so fortunate that in the last few years, since 2021, we've had all these new treatments that are now available for myasthenia in terms of the downstream effect. So things like complement inhibitors, additional new complement inhibitors that have been approved, as well as a whole class of other medication called neonatal Fc receptor antagonists that also work pretty darn well in controlling symptoms in myasthenia.
Right, so you would say B cell or cell targeted therapies would live in the upstream region, and the antibodies and complement activation neuromuscular junction modulation would be the downstream areas.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in you touched on the different therapies that we've had. So, with the advent of eculizumab really starting the therapeutic revolution in myasthenia, first coming through in 2017, and now we have three different approved FcRn complement inhibitors, and then your second class, the FcRn inhibitors. Talk us through a little bit in terms of, well, let's start with the FcRn inhibitors, because you alluded to this before. All the myasthenia antibodies we know of are, fortunately, of the IgG subtype in terms of the main pathophysiological effect. How do you think of FcRn inhibitors, and where in your treatment paradigm do you use the FcRn inhibitors as a class?
Great question. So the FcRn antagonists, these help sort of prevent the pathogenic, so the acetylcholine receptor or antibodies from being recycled. So you get this down regulation or where they're degraded essentially by your own body. And so we tend to think of them as helping temporarily and then having a wearing off effect. And the question is how what dosing frequency can you use and how frequently what dosing frequency you can give it at. And we tend to do that based on symptoms at the moment. Others have some guidance on how frequently we should and can be doing it safely. So I tend to use it in patients who are quite symptomatic with their myasthenia to get them out of to help get them feeling a little bit better faster so that they can function and do the things they need to do. So go to work, not feel weak on when they're taking the train to go to work, or if they're having some swallowing trouble to actually help with those pieces. So for more generalized myasthenia gravis, which is outside of everything involving just the eye. So anything from the mouth kind of down through the body. And so that's how I end up using the Fc receptor antagonists.
And just to, so I understand, it's more symptom driven cycles, or in the newest approved one where nipocalimab is actually not given in a cyclic way, it's on a continuous dosing paradigm. You would use this for people who are having a high symptom burden for it. And in terms of which patients, like from the antibody subtype, you know, that the indications right now are primarily for AChR antibody and MuSK antibody. So we are, that covers most of our patients. It does leave a small proportion that wouldn't fall in those categories. So pivoting to the complement inhibitors, so there it's a different treatment paradigm, or cadence, if you will. And then the patient selection here, how do you position the complement inhibitors?
So, I mean, complement inhibitors are approved as first line therapy as well from generalized myasthenia gravis. And so I tend to use them as sort of my last resort, actually, because it requires a lot of vaccinations prior to actually giving or starting those. So, doing the whole vaccination series or starting patients on some antibiotic to prevent infections. And given the meningococcal infection risk that goes along with complement inhibitors, but they are approved as first line therapy. So I end up using them sort of as my last line if patients are not doing as well, or they have a lot of swallowing trouble and bulbar dysfunction, or definitely respiratory failure, then I will end up using those. And that's sort of my last tool in my toolkit right now.
Okay, so again, just in terms of the downstream mechanisms, the complement inhibitors you're using more in what might have been termed previously as refractory disease, although just to point out their indication for none of them includes that term. So it is, as you mentioned, available for use in any patient with acetylcholine receptor antibody. I would want also want to point out here is you alluded to you talked about the complement activation in AChR. It's not a major mechanism that we think of for the MuSK. So here, MuSK patients or potentially patients who we don't know which antibody they have may be precluded for use of the complement inhibitors because of this difference between the antibody subtypes. So in terms of now, let's go to your upstream mechanism. So let's talk about the B cell targeting, and it's been a bit of a fun ride when it comes to B cell targeting. Let's talk about our best known B cell and inhibitor being CD20 targeted rituximab. Walk us through what the history has been for rituximab in acetylcholine receptor antibody myasthenia.
So rituximab has been, or CD20 binding agents have been really, they initially were case series, case reports of use of rituximab in particular in refractory myasthenia gravis. And there was good results and good experience with other physicians around the country with using rituximab, which led to a study called the BEAT-MG study, which looked at, doses of rituximab and then looking at steroid sparing effect at basically 52 weeks out and seeing if there was any reduction in what we call our myasthenia gravis activities of daily living, as well as a steroid sparing effect. And that unfortunately did not show any huge improvement necessarily in achieving the primary endpoint, which was dose reduction of steroids at 52 weeks out. So that was a little disappointing. However, we have continued to use rituximab in MuSK myasthenia. So this was in AChR positive in particular. And then there was another trial that was done called the RINAMAX trial, which looked at early onset myasthenia defined as within or within the first 12 months of symptom onset of their myasthenia. and using a single dose of 500 milligrams of IV rituximab in those patients. And they found actually steroid sparing effect and less exacerbations in those patients at 16 weeks out, which actually gave a lot of promise towards using B cell depletion early on in myasthenia and helping to prevent exacerbations and have a steroid sparing effect.
Right. Yeah, it's always a struggle for me to state exactly what the BEAT MG trial primary endpoint was. And Richard Novak, who was the primary author and lead author, for that study, always corrects me on this. It was designed as a futility study, and I think the way it's, that rituximab was not convincingly better than steroids. Or then placebo in reducing the steroid requirement without while maintaining a treatment effect. So yeah, it was definitely a downer in a sense in not showing or showing fertility and not going on to a phase three. And as you mentioned, the Rhinomax trial helped us go back a little bit on that. So in terms of our newest trial using a monoclonal antibody. So inebilizumab, the pivotal trial was dubbed MINT. How do you see the data from the MINT trial?
I think that data is very promising in showing that the two initial induction doses followed by maintenance actually helped not only with the MG-ADL scores, but then and the QMG scores, but also there was a steroid sparing design or steroid taper for steroid taper in that, which at 6 months out showed that patients were able to reduce their steroid burden. And not have as many exacerbations as compared to placebo. And I think that is very promising as a design of a study and very promising results.
Yeah, and again, just to highlight the way the study was designed, it was initially for with different time point outcomes for the AChR group versus the MuSK group, and the benefit that you mentioned that was seen in both groups. So first trial where you've got a clear two distinct subtypes of MG and showing benefit with the CD20 target CD19 targeting. What do you make of the difference then between the CD19 versus CD20? How can you elaborate a little bit on that, what that targeting difference means?
So, I mean, we think of more, so we have lots of different types of B cells and different maturation of B cells in terms of their lineage and the in terms of how B cells mature. And so CD20 is expressed on some, expressed on actually some immature B cells. And for the most part, on most cells, but once they become very mature, they actually do lose the CD20 and have really CD19 persistence. So in plasma blasts, which are the ones that we think can drive a lot of the antibody production. And so I think it's just a slightly different mechanism that may help in terms of binding the CD9 and CD19s, I apologize, is like expressed pretty on most B cells in terms of their maturation. So it's just broader targeting of the B cell populations that may be helping partly with this.
So there is a distinct subgroup of B cells that are being targeted by rituximab, which is different from what inebilizumab targets. So these are not equivalent medications in that sense. All right. And so when you think about having access, hopefully in the near in the future, to CD19 targeted therapies, where would you position B cell targeted therapies compared to what we talked about for the FcRns and complement inhibitors?
I think it just depends on how patients look, truthfully, when they're coming in. I think targeting upstream is better to try and prevent the disease from progressing, but often that takes a little bit of time to actually work versus like the downstream effect where or downstream sort of mediators where they work a little bit faster in actually helping patients get symptomatically better, and so that they can again go back to what they need to be doing and living their lives. So I think we have to think about it as like short-term and sort of long-term benefit. And we don't have good data on how these will be used as sort of together. We just know that steroids have worked for patients like in the MINT study. Steroids do work, and this longer term treatment path may be helpful with using CD19 as a target.
And so when we talked a little bit about the cadence of these treatments, and whereas for the complement inhibitors you have chronic intermittent dosing, with the FcRn inhibitors you have either cyclic dosing or, in the case of nipocalimab, chronic intermittent dosing. How do you think about the dosing paradigm for these therapies versus the B cell targeted therapies?
I mean, it's much easier to do the two initial infusions followed by maintenance dose, much easier in terms of burden of care. Cost will be an issue for all of these drugs that are now the cost will be an issue based on how inebilizumab will be actually priced for this. We don't know, and if it gets approved, so. I think that'll be a huge consideration for patients as well. But I think in terms of burden of like actual treatments, infusions, I think that'll be a little bit better, as compared to some of the more intermittent dosing that we've seen.
Sure. And just to clarify on that point, inebilizumab is currently approved for use in other neurological disorders. So it is in market for that, not pending approval in myasthenia gravis. In terms of the side effect profile, so efficacy is obviously very important, but another important aspect of treatment decision making is the side effect profile, safety and tolerability. How do you view, in your experience, what has been the safety and tolerability with the complement inhibitors and the FcRn inhibitors?
Truthfully, they've been pretty well tolerated in most patients whenever prescribed it. We hear about risk of upper respiratory infections with the FcRns, as well as some injection site reactions where patients. But those are honestly most well tolerated for most of the patients I've prescribed those to. The complement inhibitors honestly have also been pretty well tolerated in terms of the self-injection or versus the IVs given every 2 weeks or 8 weeks at the moment. So those have been pretty well tolerated. It's the vaccination burden that sometimes gets in the way for the complement inhibitors to initially start them. But once patients get over that hump, they're actually tolerated pretty well. In comparison to inebilizumab, we know that there is a theoretical infection risk, but the data reported out did not show those are the most common side effects, but it's not and it may not be any different as compared to the FcRns or the complement inhibitors.
Right, and again, I echo your sentiment. In my experience as well, the complement inhibitors and FcRn inhibitors have, by and large, been well tolerated. I feel like as neurologists, we are not very well equipped to monitor for increased infection risk, and we don't hear about it very much unless we specifically are asking our patients. At some recent meetings, other colleagues have really brought this to my attention to be watching, particularly for urinary tract infections in some of my patients on FcRn. And of course, once they mentioned that, I've now had two patients who reported some of those issues. So, yes, I think perhaps we need to have a better understanding on how to do monitoring for this increased infection risk with all of these therapies that we use. And that also dates back to our traditional standard of care therapies with the prednisone and the non-steroidal agents. I don't think we do that very well in terms of infection surveillance. As things stand right now, what advice would you like to share with our audience in terms of where to position these the conventional therapies and these new targeted therapies that are coming through the what we already have in hand, and then what hopefully is going to be coming down the pipeline.
I think it depends on the patient and how they look. So I think any decision has to be made with the patient and what their goals are, and and if they look actually pretty mild to moderate and are tolerating well, early use of the B cell depletion might be helpful in those patients. While using a downstream mediator for patients who are very symptomatic, and cannot kind of go about with their life using those to get them a little bit better. And once they're a little bit better, maybe then consider using something like this as a B cell depleter for longer term management. But everything depends on the patient and what they look like. So I think it takes good clinical judgment at that moment and good shared decision making to make a decision of which one to use.
Awesome. Well,
How would you do this, Dr. Habib? What do you think?
thank you for flipping the script on me. It's interesting. I think we are in a very dynamic time where we're learning how to use all of these therapies side by side as well as sequentially. And I think if pre advent of the complement inhibitors, it was really sequential treatment that we were using for our available therapies. And now it's become more of an overlapping paradigm. So we are using the traditional therapies along with the targeted therapies like FcRn and complement inhibitors. And the newer therapies that are coming, like the B cell targeted therapies, hope they're it's going to be a learning experience. So I think the field is evolving over time. I think probably the biggest change we will see, I'm pulling out my crystal ball here, is the field move towards more aggressive approach. So we've done, as a field, we've had amazing success in reducing the mortality from myasthenia, but that was so last century. And now where our target has been faster acting, deeper response therapies. And we've done that with the FcRn and complement inhibitors. To me, the next stage is sustained effect. And that's what some of the newer therapies may enable us to do. So be able to give therapies have sustained efficacy without the need for redosing on a frequent basis, at least. So a lot to learn over the next few years in terms of managing myasthenia gravis.
Yeah, I agree. I think we may end up seeing the field moving towards the combinations of these things and figuring out how to do that piece. And I think it'll be an interesting learning experience as more people prescribe these, and then how do we actually fit these in? So I think our guidelines will probably change actually as we get more data.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for all your insights, and thank you for joining us today for this conversation.
Thank you so much, Dr. Habib, for having me.